Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello and welcome back. We are here to tell you about our world and help you learn American English. We begin today with a story of terrible violence in Texas. You may have heard that biker gangs were involved in a recent clash. Then something a lot more pleasant. Some young people from Washington, D.C. are learning their schoolwork at a very unusual place. The program is called As It Is, and it begins right now. Texas police are guarding against violence after a clash between competing motorcycle gangs. 9 people were killed in the fighting last Sunday in the city of Waco, Texas. Waco police say they seized more than 100 guns and arrested about 170 people. It was one of the worst gunfights in recent United States history. The gunfight has led police and others to look closely at motorcycle gangs, bikers who travel together on their motorcycles. Law enforcement officials say such groups are a great threat to public safety. Police say the gunfight in Waco was a clash between a large Texas-based gang called the Banditos and smaller gangs, including one called the Cossacks. Sergeant Patrick Swanton is a member of the Waco Police Department.
I will tell you that in 34 years of law enforcement, this is the worst crime scene, the most violent crime scene that I have ever been involved in.
Sergeant Swanton says police knew the gangs were gathering in Waco and followed them closely as they traveled to the city. Some police officers were sent to a Waco restaurant. Sergeant Swanton says they were prepared to take action if the two sides fought.
We were extremely fortunate to have our best, most well-trained officers here, and that was our tactical unit. They were here for the specific reason of we knew there was going to be trouble at this biker event.
Sergeant Swanton says the gang members fired at each other, and some also fired at the police. But only gang members were wounded or killed. Federal and state officials say the Banditos gang has about 2,000 members. They say it is involved in the transport of illegal drugs and other kinds of organized crime. The Banditos was formed in South Texas in the 1960s. It now has allied chapters or smaller groups in other states and in several countries. James Quinn teaches sociology at the University of North Texas. He has studied biker gangs. He says one chapter can operate differently from another. He notes that some gangs have what he calls a sophisticated membership that is active in organized crime. Other chapters appeal to those interested in riding, drinking, or making friends. The Hell's Angels biker group is based in California. It competes with the Banditos for members. Hell's Angels is much larger than the Banditos. Yet both groups have chapters throughout the country and the world. The two groups have clashed in Australia, Western Europe, and Canada. Canadian reporter Julian Scher has written 2 books about the gangs. Mr. Scher says the level of violence may decrease for a time after the gunfight in Waco. But he says the two sides will fight again someday because biker gangs always fight.
The image of the biker gangs really never changes. This is what they're about. This is their very nature. And it was just pure luck that there were no innocent people killed in that shootout, but there have been cases where innocent people have been killed.
Most of those arrested in Waco belong to the Banditos group. City officials are worried that other Banditos members could travel to Waco and fight with members of competing groups who are still there. State police and federal officials are in Waco to help local police investigate the gunfight and to prevent more violence. I'm Jim Tedder. You are listening to The Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. The spring term is coming to an end at colleges and universities across the United States. The past few weeks were a busy time for many students, including those at Washington Adventist University near Washington, D.C. Some students from the university have been helping poor, mostly immigrant children with their schoolwork. But the students did not work with the boys and girls at a traditional school. Every Thursday night, they have been meeting at a laundromat, a place where people go to wash their clothes. Christopher Jones Cruz reports.
Every week, many people bring their clothing and their children to the Rainbow Coin Laundry. While the parents wash the clothes, the children are busy learning. Some children completed their schoolwork with help from Washington Adventist University student Heather Alas.
We want to help the little kids with their homework. A lot of them don't understand English all that well. So we do try to make sure that they understand their homework because sometimes their parents aren't able to help as well.
Christine Sumampau is also a tutor in the program. She says the program began with just five children, but has grown to about 20. She has been writing a marketing plan for Nok Kim, the owner of the laundromat. They created the idea of a tutoring program to give people a reason to keep coming to the laundromat.
He's really friendly with his customers, so we figure why don't we try something that he can give to the community.
The project began last year when Nok Kim asked Kimberly Pichot for help. Ms. Pichot is the head of the university's business department.
When we first started working with him, business was bad, which is why we came in. He'd even considered closing his business. But the conversation got started, and we said, okay, let's do a facelift. Let's redesign his logo. And the ideas just started coming. And as we were brainstorming, one student says, you know, there's a lot of immigrant children hanging around. Why don't we add tutoring?
Mr. Kim says the laundromat is slowly getting more business. The project is part of an international entrepreneurial program called Enactus. It was launched in the United States 40 years ago. The program is now at more than 1,700 college and university campuses in 36 countries.
They want to give students experience before they graduate. And so we collaborate with the community and with businesses, and we find things that the students can do to enhance the community.
Ms. Pichot says her students are working with other businesses in addition to the Rainbow Coin Laundry.
Every year we start the year out with a small business symposium, and we invite any business to come in. It's a free workshop. And so from that symposium, we self-select. We see who wants to work with whom. And then throughout the year, we help other businesses with accounting, with taxes, with marketing, cost analysis, a variety of things. So this year, we've worked with a restaurant. We just started working with a tax service to help them expand to a second location. We've worked with sports trainers to help expand a dance club.
She says the students help business owners increase their profits while gaining experience that they cannot get in school.
And so the depth of their learning is a world apart from just that dry classroom environment where they walk away with a few concepts. They volunteer long hours.
Christine Sumampau is completing her studies this year. She has spent about 1,000 hours as a volunteer. That is more than any other student in the group. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report.
As an English learner, you want to be able to understand and to discuss a subject. You want to have the ability to express your opinions and to support that opinion with a clear argument. You can learn these skills by learning how to debate. In everyday conversation, Americans use the word debate to talk about discussions among people. When people debate, they give their own opinions about a topic. Another use of the word debate describes a more formal discussion. Debaters work on a team to convince a judge that their opinion about a topic has more value than the opposite side's opinion.
Debate is part of the tradition of forensics started in ancient Greece. The Greeks thought that in a democracy, people needed to have certain skills. These skills included speaking in public in favor of an opinion, and providing evidence to support one's opinion. The Greeks supported the development of these skills by holding contests. Western education today continues the tradition with competitions between debate teams. A debate contest traditionally has this structure. Teams agree to debate a resolution, a statement, such as nuclear power should be banned. One team is the affirmative team in support of the resolution. One is the negative, against the resolution. Each team gives an argument for or against the resolution. Then each team ask questions about the other team's argument. After answering the questions, each team makes more statements to support their argument. Finally, they summarize the arguments. In a classic debate, teams may take 12 turns, in which one member of the team speaks.
Professor Charles LeBeau teaches English and debate in Japan.
There is a huge gap between presentation, which is mostly a one-way experience, and then we have something on the other end of the spectrum, which is discussion. The problem with discussion is that there's no real clear exacting format.
Mr. LeBeau says that most people mistake debate as being mostly a speaking skill, but debate is a more natural kind of discussion than what happens in those classrooms. That is because debate requires understanding the other person's opinion.
The nice thing about debate is debate leads towards a more natural discussion. First, I give my position, then you give your position, and then I would address each of the points in your position and comment on them. And then you would have the opportunity to address each point in my position and comment on it.
In part two of our series, we will introduce a simple method for teaching debate to English learners. Mr. LeBeau will tell how using a graphic helps students organize their thoughts and debate with more confidence. For the VOA Education Report, I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm Jonathan Evans.
Thank you. Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. American military planners had to make an important decision when the United States entered the Second World War at the end of 1941. American forces could not fight effectively in Asia and Europe at the same time. The military planners decided to use most of their forces to defeat the German troops of Adolf Hitler. Only after victory over the Nazis was clear in Europe would they use all of America's strength to fight Japan in Asia and the Pacific. Because of this decision, Japan was able to win many of the early battles of the war in Asia. The fighting in the Pacific is the subject of our program this week. Japanese planes bombed the American naval base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii on December 7, 1941.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii by air, President Roosevelt has just announced.
We take you now to Washington.
The attack apparently was made on all naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu.
The surprise raid marked the first of several major victories for the Japanese. Shortly after Pearl Harbor, Imperial forces attacked American bases in the Philippines. And within days, Japan captured the American island of Guam. Japanese troops landed in Thailand. They marched into Malaya, and they seized Hong Kong. The Japanese also moved into Indonesia and Burma. Even Hitler's troops in Europe had not moved so quickly or successfully. As one American historian wrote later, the Pacific Ocean looked like a Japanese lake. The United States began to fight back. General Jimmy Doolittle led a group of 16 American B-25 bombers that took off from the aircraft carrier Hornet and bombed Tokyo in a surprise raid.
5:11 o'clock. The bathroom, would you? I said.
The B-25 was selected because it was small, because it had the sufficient range to carry 2,000-pound bombs, 2,000 miles, and because it took off and handled very well.
It was a bold move. The B-25 had never been launched from an aircraft carrier before, and the demands on the planes and the pilots were even greater with the weight of a full load of bombs. Japan's leaders believed no army could stop them, so they expanded their goals and launched new campaigns. That was Japan's mistake. It stretched its forces too thin and too quickly. The military leaders in Tokyo believed that the United States could not resist because American forces were busy fighting the war in Europe. But no country could extend its communications and fighting ability over such a great distance and continue to win. The turning point came in June 1942 in the Central Pacific with the Great Battle of Midway Island. Japanese Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto launched the battle. He wanted to meet and destroy the remaining ships in the American fleet before the United States could recover from the destruction at Pearl Harbor. Yamamoto had 162 ships. The American Admiral, Chester Nimitz, had just 76. But the United States had discovered how to read the secret messages of the Japanese forces. For this reason, Nimitz and the Americans knew exactly where the Japanese ships would sail, and they put their own ships in the best positions to stop them. The fighting between the two sides was fierce, but when it ended, the Americans had won a great victory. Admiral Yamamoto was forced to call off his attack and sail home. For the first time, the Japanese Navy had been defeated. The next big battle was at Guadalcanal, one of the Solomon Islands in the southwestern Pacific. Guadalcanal's beaches were wide and flat. Japanese officers decided to build a military airbase there. The United States learned of the plans. American commanders decided that they had to prevent Japan from establishing that base. United States Marines quickly landed on the island. They were joined by troops from Australia and New Zealand. But Japanese ships launched a surprise attack and destroyed many of the American ships in the harbor. Allied forces on the island were left without naval support and suffered heavy losses. For 6 months, the two sides fought for control of the island. Historian and naval officer Samuel Elliott Morrison described the fighting this way in his book, The Struggle for Guadalcanal.
For us who were there, or whose friends were there, Guadalcanal is not a name but an emotion, recalling desperate fights in the air, various night naval battles, frantic work at supply or construction, savage fighting in the sodden jungle, nights broken by screaming bombs and deafening explosions of naval shells.
The fighting continued seemingly forever. But finally, in February 1943, the Japanese were forced to leave Guadalcanal. The battle was an important defeat for Japan. It opened the door for the American and other Allied forces to go on the attack after months of defensive fighting. But American military planners did not agree about the best way to launch such an attack. Admiral Nimitz of the Navy wanted to capture the small groups of Japanese-held islands in the Pacific, then seize Taiwan, and finally attack Japan itself. But General Douglas MacArthur of the Army thought it would be best to attack through New Guinea and the Philippines. The American leadership finally decided to launch both attacks at once. Nimitz and MacArthur both succeeded. Nimitz and his naval forces moved quickly through the Marianas and other islands. General MacArthur's troops attacked through New Guinea and into the Philippines. American ships defeated Japanese naval forces in the battle for Leyte Gulf. Throughout the Pacific and East Asia, the fighting continued. Many of the fiercest battles were fought on tiny Pacific islands. Japanese troops captured the islands early in the war, and they quickly built strong defenses to prevent the Allies from invading. Allied military leaders found a way to defeat the Japanese plan. They simply avoided the islands where the Japanese were strong
and attacked other islands. But sometimes the Allies could not avoid a battle. They had to land on some islands to seize airfields for American planes. The names of these islands became well known. Tarawa in the Gilbert Islands, Truk in the Marshall Islands, Saipan in the Marianas, and other islands including Guam and Tinian. The two sides fought fiercely in the Battle of Iwo Jima. And on Okinawa, Japanese forces resisted for 83 days before finally being defeated by Allied troops. After the defeat at Okinawa, many Japanese understood that the war was lost, even if Japan had not yet surrendered. Emperor Hirohito appointed a new prime minister and ordered him to explore the possibilities of peace. But both sides still expected the Allies to launch a final invasion into Japan itself, and everyone knew that the cost in human life would be great for both sides. But the invasion never came. For years, American scientists had been developing a secret weapon, the atomic bomb. The code name was the Manhattan Project. President Harry S. Truman made the decision to use it against Japan.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. We won the race of discovery against the Germans. We have used it in order to shorten the agony of war, in order to save the lives of thousands and thousands of young Americans. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war.
American planes dropped one of the bombs on Hiroshima on August 6, 1945. And another on Nagasaki 3 days later. Exactly how many people in those two cities died from the force and heat of the blasts, or later from radiation, may never be known. The Radiation Effects Research Foundation in Japan estimates that between 150,000 and 246,000 died within 2 to 4 months of the bombings. Japan surrendered on August 15, 1945, 6 days after the Nagasaki bombing. Suddenly, sooner than expected, World War II was over. More than 50 million civilians and soldiers died during the 6 years of fighting. Germany and Japan were defeated. The Soviet Union was strong in much of Eastern Europe, but the United States found itself the strongest military, economic, and political power in the world. Our story continues next week. Our program was adapted from a script by David Jarmel. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and pictures at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English.